WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, divisions within the American Jewish community. We talked to Sam Friedman, author of Jew vs. Jew. He says that although American Jews face comparatively few problems related to anti-Semitism, there are growing conflicts within the Jewish community, the conflicts between secularism and fundamentalism, assimilation and segregation. We'll also talk about reaction within the Jewish community to the nomination of Joe Lieberman. And TV critic David Bianculli looks ahead to tonight's final episode of Survivor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sam Friedman, has written a new book called Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. It relates to a couple of important issues in the news, the nomination of the first Jewish vice presidential candidate, Joe Lieberman, and a new proposal by Israel's prime minister that would take some of the power away from the ultra-Orthodox. Friedman says that among American Jews, he's witnessing a struggle that pits secularist against believer, denomination against denomination, traditionalist against modernist. The struggle is being waged on issues ranging from who can convert to Judaism to the Israeli peace process and the role of women in worship. The fundamental questions are, what is the definition of Jewish identity and who decides what is authentic and legitimate Judaism? Friedman is a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and a former reporter for the New York Times. Let's start with reactions within the Jewish community to the nomination of Joe Lieberman.
There are two really different reactions that you hear in the Jewish community. One is this incredible swelling of communal pride that reminds me always of the stories my mother told me about being a teenager in the Bronx when Bess Meyerson was selected the first Jewish Miss America. Obviously, this is on a much grander, more profound level, but it's that same kind of sense of shared joy. On the other hand, something I've heard pretty commonly, which I find very disconcerting, is a sort of an expectation that there is some hidden reservoir of anti-Semitism out there that's going to make itself felt in the privacy of the voting booth, and that somehow Joe Lieberman and the Jews will be blamed if the ticket loses, or there'll be this unexpected difference in what polling shows the Gore-Lieberman ticket will get versus how it actually draws on election day. And that has really given me a lot of despair because I think that it shows such a misreading of what the Jewish experience in America has been, both politically and socially. And then there's a third element to the reaction, which is that some of the aspects of Joe Lieberman's identity, his orthodox observance that make him very appealing, ironically, to Christians and I think to Catholics, and certainly I can say out of my own experience having written a book about a black church, give him a sense of identity and connection to blacks who are very active in their churches, are disconcerting to Jews of a more secular or a non-orthodox bent. It really is like that Jackie Mason riff about things that are too Jewish, that I think that in a quiet way that a lot of Jews wouldn't reveal outside the tribe, there's this worry that why does he have to talk about God? Why does he have to mention the Almighty? Why does he have to quote from the Torah, or not from the Torah, from the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, in his first speech in Nashville? Because that kind of open embrace of religion really in some ways runs at odds to what for most of the Jewish experience in America has been the dominant mode of being an American, which was really an erosion of religious identity and a richness of ethnic or cultural identity and a desire to move into the mainstream. What Joel Lieberman, by his example, shows is this interesting countervailing trend, which we've particularly seen since World War II, which is that orthodoxy, instead of falling away as people expected, has resurged and has come to be more and more influential. But it also continues to be, in some ways within the Jewish world, quite a controversial proposition.
Now, your book, Jew versus Jew, is examining splits within the Jewish community between different branches of the faith. Joe Lieberman is part of the group known as Modern Orthodox. What does that mean?
Modern Orthodox is a movement that began in Germany during the Enlightenment, but really reached fruition in America in beginning in the 1920s and growing steadily since then. The idea of modern orthodoxy is that to be orthodox isn't to be an isolationist. It isn't to be cut off from the modern world. It isn't to fear the modern world. There was an idea in a lot of European orthodoxy that was summed up by an aphorism from Rabbi that translated as, "What's new is forbidden by the Torah." And what the founders and the developers of modern orthodoxy felt was the opposite, was that you should engage with the modern world. Their motto, which later became the motto of Yeshiva University, is Torah Umada, which literally means something along the lines of Torah study and the study of worldly secular subjects. But it has a deeper meaning, too. And the deeper meaning is that an observant Orthodox Jew should get out and collide and rub up against and immerse oneself in the larger world, that there's a dynamic encounter that's healthy, and even to the degree your faith gets challenged by certain things you're thrown into, your faith is enhanced by that, but also the society is enhanced by who you are as an Orthodox Jew. And that was really the rising side of Orthodoxy in this country from about the 20s to about the 50s or 60s. And what's happened since then is that there's been this countervailing trend of ultra-Orthodoxy, the so-called Haredi Orthodox. Haredi means those who tremble with awe at God. And that's more of, I think, the stereotype a lot of listeners will have of Orthodoxy, people who will either be Hasidic in black hat, in black coats and forelocks, or certainly will dress in sober suits all the time and may have their fringes, their tzitzis, hanging out on their garments, and will have a very wary kind of relationship with the larger world. And they've really been, their boom has actually in many ways trumped the modern Orthodox boom over the last 20 or 30 years, and they've pulled much of American Orthodoxy to the right, politically and theologically.
How large would you say each of those Orthodox branches are, the modern Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox?
I'm trying to think of the demographics on that. I know that Orthodoxy as a whole is figured at anywhere between 7% and 10% of the total Jewish population, which is 5.5 million. So let's say, if you assume that there are roughly 400,000 to 500,000 Orthodox Jews in America, I think the split numerically is pretty close to equal right now between those who would identify as modern and those who would identify as Haredim. But the Haredim have a much higher birth rate. The modern Orthodox have a birth rate twice as high as the rest of American Jewry, but ultra-Orthodox have a birth rate twice as high as modern Orthodox. And ironically, because the modern Orthodox go out into the world to be lawyers, to be surgeons, to be professors, to be financial consultants, they've ended up creating a vacuum in their own institutions that even in many modern Orthodox day schools, that is to say parochial schools, and even at Yeshiva University, which is the really intellectual capital of modern Orthodoxy, a lot of the teaching is done by ultra-Orthodox educators, because in the ultra-Orthodox world, where there's more of an ambivalent sense about going out into a profession that's going to really take you into secular America, to be an educator has an esteem that it doesn't have, frankly, in the modern Orthodox world. And so modern Orthodox kids go to day schools and get taught by ultra-Orthodox educators, and it's created a really interesting tension and a kind of generational phenomenon that's sometimes called flipping, where the kids of modern Orthodox families come to doubt and even ultimately reject their own parents' version of Orthodoxy and go to something that they perceive as being purer, which is in the ultra-Orthodox world.
Would it be fair to say that the modern Orthodox consider themselves very observant, whereas the ultra-Orthodox could perhaps be compared to fundamentalists?
Well, I think you're basically right there. I think what's even more the cutting edge is that the modern Orthodox consider themselves observant to all the Orthodox laws, and the ultra-Orthodox cast doubt on that. Something that just happened recently, which is a sign of this kind of insecurity that's gripped a lot of modern Orthodoxy, is that Joel Lieberman, in this article in The Times, called himself observant rather than Orthodox, as if even the term Orthodox is something even this modern Orthodox hero doesn't want to lay claim to. And already there's been this kind of concession that a lot of modern Orthodox people have made of the term modern Orthodox, that some of them now prefer to call themselves centrist Orthodox, as if modern has become a pejorative, like saying you're a liberal in political matters. It has some weird taint to it. Theologically, the modern Orthodox would say that they're no different from the ultra-Orthodox, because what they all believe, what's the linchpin of Orthodoxy in any guise, is that both the Torah and that the Torah was the revealed word of God, that it's, to use a term that Christians use, it has inerrancy of text. The difference, though, is that then you have this body of commentary that develops later on the oral law, which is the Talmud. And the Talmud is filled with disputation and different opinions by different rabbis in antiquity about what it means. And a lot of the division between modern Orthodoxy and ultra-Orthodoxy really comes down to what commentaries you choose to follow. And this process of commenting on it and analyzing and interpreting persists to the current day. So if Joe Lieberman, like a number of modern Orthodox people I know, is in favor of abortion rights, there would be a line of Talmudic interpretation that would give sanction to that. And they would see that as theologically legitimate. The ultra-Orthodox would cite a different line of interpretation and different biblical passages to say, no, that the text and the rabbis are clearly against abortion. And that's where you get this tension on a lot of what would otherwise look like civil, political issues rather than overtly religious ones.
My guest is Sam Friedman, author of the new book Jew versus Jew. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sam Friedman, author of the new book Jew versus Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. One of the points of your book is that there's really a growing tension now between secular Jews and the ultra-Orthodox Jews. And secular Jews are Jewish people for whom Judaism may be an important part of their identity, but going to synagogue isn't at the center of their lives. They might not even go to synagogue or might only go on the high holy days. So Judaism is for secular Jews more of a culture than it is of a religion per se. Is that an accurate description?
That's exactly right. And the split isn't just between secular and ultra-Orthodox. It's very much between secular and modern Orthodox as well. And there are divides even within each denomination, mm-hmm. the conservative and reform denominations as well, between a small number, relatively speaking, of followers who tend to be quite observant in reform or conservative modes, and a majority who might belong to a synagogue or a temple, but really live most of their lives away from it, except for attending on the high holy days.
Now, you tell a story in your book about a couple in Long Island who wanted to move from their neighborhood because the neighborhood was becoming more Orthodox, and they found it very confusing and very alienating. What were some of the problems they had with their neighborhood that was becoming increasingly ultra-Orthodox?
Well, the problems they had were similar to ones that have come up really in scores of other communities. This was in Great Neck, but also could just as easily have been in Beechwood, Ohio, a Cleveland suburb that I write about at length, or in the Five Towns on Long Island, or Teaneck, New Jersey, a variety of places. It had to do largely with the public face of Orthodox observance, that their Orthodox neighbors would have lots of people over for Sabbath lunch, which is an Orthodox tradition. And so the sense of, well, there's always noise and crowds in the backyard. They would build a sukkah, that's an outdoor booth for the holiday of Sukkot. And that was seen by the secular neighbors as kind of putting their religion up in the secularist's face. And kind of the thing that you keep hearing again as you go from Jewish community to Jewish community, and the perfect example of reverse reality, of the same events being perceived in irreconcilable ways, is the secular or less observant family driving in their car on a Saturday morning and finding in the street in front of them a couple of Orthodox mothers pushing strollers. Now, what does that mean? From the Orthodox standpoint, what it means is that sidewalks are narrow, and if you're walking to synagogue with a baby carriage and you want to be able to talk to your friend who is her baby carriage, you need to get out into the street to have enough room to walk two abreast. To the non-Orthodox, what it means is they're censuring me. This is their way. By getting in the way of my car, they're saying, you're desecrating our Sabbath, we're going to make life hard for you, and we're now setting the tone of what Jewish life is around here. And that's why these battles are so intense and why they're more than just spats between neighbors, because what they're really about is sort of the ownership of Jewish identity.
And I think that there are members of the ultra-Orthodox who have become very activist in trying to convert other Jews to ultra-Orthodoxy. There are people from the Lubavitcher denomination who will almost like chase after other Jewish people and try to get them to become more Orthodox. They try to get men to use some of the garments of the ultra-Orthodox in their prayers. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of Jewish people find that really baffling and alienating.
Right. Well, partly it's because the Jewish experience is not to evangelize outside the faith. There's no Jewish equivalent, and there never has been since the very, very early centuries of Jewish life, of going out to try to make converts out of non-Jews, as opposed to, say, the Christian tradition, where going out and converting the world is very much at the center of Christian purpose. And so for Jews to find their own ultra-Orthodox, evangelizing them is baffling, is disconcerting, sometimes is taken as insulting. The Lubavitcher Hasidim are famous for this, for their so-called mitzvah tanks, which are these minivans that go around to neighborhoods, and they'll go up to people and ask, are you Jewish, and get them to come in and put on, the men put on tefillin, which are the leather straps, the phylacteries that you wear around your arm and on your forehead when you pray. And then other very sophisticated groups, like a group called Eisha Torah, which has the backing of some big non-Orthodox people in the media, paradoxically, like Larry King and Kirk Douglas, which very aggressively go out and, again, try to evangelize non-Orthodox Jews. And Eish brags on the fact that if you give them a non-observant Jew in 3 months, they can turn that person Orthodox.
The split between the ultra-Orthodox and the rest of the Jewish population is even, I think, more extreme in Israel than it is in the United States. In Israel, it's kind of a battle for what the laws will be. The ultra-Orthodox would like to see the laws of the state be the same as Jewish law, and the rest of the population wants to see civil law rule and not religious law. They want to be able to do what they want to do on the Sabbath and not be ruled by the Jewish law. And there's a new development in that debate that I'd like you to talk about.
Prime Minister Barak has now brought back up his initiative to take away the draft deferment from yeshiva students and has also talked about instituting civil marriage. And these are ways of really reasserting or asserting in some ways for the first time the primacy of the state of Israel over the religious establishment. What's very complicated in Israel is that even though most Americans think of Zionism as having been this very secular and socialistic and in some ways both particularistic but also universalistic political movement, and we think of Israel as the kibbutzes and all these secular against socialistic trappings, the early Zionists knew that they needed, for political reasons, for coalition reasons, the involvement and the support of some of the religious establishment. So back even before there was a Jewish state, you had Theodor Herzl and other Zionist leaders promising the Orthodox rabbinate dominion over certain areas of civil life, just the way that the rabbinate used to have dominion over these things in the shtetls and in the ghettos of Eastern Europe. So from the very beginning of Israeli statehood, there's been this ambiguous relationship between synagogue and state, in which the Orthodox have had all the power over performing marriages, over performing burials. The religious sites in the country, like the Western Wall, are dealt with as if there were Orthodox synagogues specifically. In other words, you can't have men and women worshiping together. You have these draft deferments for the yeshiva students. That has become more and more controversial in Israel, less and less tenable politically, and is part of what's very destabilizing in Israel. The interesting thing is that when Barak was trying to make his peace treaty with the Palestinians, he had some Orthodox parties in his coalition. They deserted him, deserted the coalition, because they perceived the compromises he was willing to make as too great. Now that they're out of his coalition, he's now gone to this new package of laws that really go right at the powers, the perks, if you will, that the ultra-Orthodox, or that the Orthodox period have had in Israel from 48, when the country was founded. And that's a really, really volatile package of legislation.
Sam Friedman is the author of the new book, Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. He's a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Dell Paperbacks Division, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer, with updated listings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, finding his way back to the synagogue, we continue our conversation with Samuel Friedman, author of Jew vs. Jew. And David Bianculli shares his predictions for tonight's conclusion of Survivor. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Sam Friedman, author of the new book Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. It's about the conflicts between secularists and believers, traditionalists and modernists. You went to Israel and went to the wall in Jerusalem to watch a rabbi from the conservative wing of Judaism lead members of his congregation in prayer. What happened?
This was the holiday of Shavuot in 1999, and it's traditional to go to stay up all night studying from the Torah and then at daybreak to go to the Western Wall. And you have this amazing rapture scene of people flooding down the narrow lanes of the old city and going to the plaza, the Kotel, in front of the Wailing Wall. Tens of thousands of them are there worshiping the traditional way, men and women separated by a barrier that's called a mechitza. Then there was this small, several hundred person congregation led by a conservative rabbi from Philadelphia. Most of the people in the congregation were Americans who wanted to worship as conservative and Reform Jews worship, which is with men and women together, with women being able to read from the Torah. And over the course of the morning, from about 4 a.m. when we got there up to about 7 when it ended, the tension pretty much built and built and built. There would be hecklers along the barricades that had been set up around us to protect us. And it starts out with a couple of teenagers heckling and, you know, making nasty jokes and talking about, do your rabbis, you know, perform homosexual weddings? Do your, you know, comparing people to gorillas, you know, singing songs about, you know, the goyim, the Gentiles. And then it was this truly frightening experience in seeing mob psychology, because it lapsed for a while. And then when the women started to read from the Torah, it built again. And all of a sudden there are bottles, these plastic juice or soda bottles, come winging in from way out in the crowd, still half filled, so they have a lot of impact. And, you know, I saw this woman get clocked in the head and collapse right down on the plaza, almost knocked out. And there are kids in strollers, little infants around. I was just thinking, man, if one of those had hit one of these children, you'd have had a dead child. A little baby could not survive a blow like that. And it continues. And every time one of these missiles comes in, the policemen who are now ringing us, trying to protect us, would run out into the crowd to try to find the perpetrators. And then you'd see a bunch of the ultra-Orthodox chasing after the police and trying to keep them from apprehending. And there would be some ultra-Orthodox, some yeshiva girls, and this one particular rabbi who'd come to the front barricade and plead with the black hats, with the Haredim there, not to attack other Jews, not to do this. And they were totally ignored. I remember these yeshiva girls leaving in tears because their advice wasn't being heeded. And so the whole experience of being at the center of this attack, of this kind of hatred made real with bottles, was indelible. And this is the kind, you know, to have to go through a worship service with one eye trying to follow the liturgy and one ear trying to follow the chanting of the prayers, and then your other eye and your other ear trying to figure out if something's coming in from back in the crowd, another bottle is coming in, really leaves you rattled. And more than individually rattled, these are the kind of events, because they very much involve American Jews, either who've emigrated to Israel or who are there for study or on visit, that have created this tremendous sense of alienation on the part of non-Orthodox American Jews from Israel. They come back and they tell the people in their neighbors and their congregations about what happened. I think that it's part of why they feel more and more separate from Israel and from the Israeli, the Zionist enterprise now, because there's a sense of this isn't a country I can share in anymore.
Yeah, and as you say in your book, Israel, which used to unite the American Jewish community, seems to divide it now.
That's right. Israel was this talisman. I certainly remember it from growing up and during the 67 war and the 73 war, the mass meetings, the fundraising, the way, you know, the admiration for the young, robust Israeli soldiers. And, you know, even it going to a Jewish day camp when I was growing up, they'd send us for an overnight to a kibbutz in central New Jersey in Hightstown that actually was like a practice kibbutz where people went before going to Israel. And now, because of not only the splits on theological issues and this whole synagogue-state separation, but also because of divides on the peace process, Israel is one more factor that tends to polarize American Jews rather than this kind of talisman on which we all lay on our hands and we're absolved of all our internal rifts here.
Do you think that the extent of the division between Jews of different denominations in the United States and in Israel is unprecedented, that this is a very recent phenomenon?
Well, there have been periods of tremendous rancor and rifts in Jewish history. But the thing that was always different in the past is that there was an outside force, some kind of oppression or persecution that would end up containing those rifts, because at the end of the day, as Herzl said, our enemies have made of us one people, that it didn't matter. And of course, the Holocaust is the ultimate example of this. It didn't matter if you were Marxist. It didn't matter if you were some cosmopolitan from the Weimar nightclubs. It didn't matter if you were an ultra-Orthodox rabbi. You're going to be named, identified, and persecuted as a Jew nonetheless. Israel is different because it's a homogeneous country for the most part. I mean, it does have a 15% Arab population, but compared to America, it's quite homogeneous. The American situation is so different because of the acceptance of Jews in America. There's nothing external in this country to create unity, to create Jewish identity. And so you're in a position where some people say, where every Jew in America is a Jew by choice, because you have to consciously decide what you are, because there's nothing from the outside that's going to make that choice for you.
Why do you think that the number of people who are of the ultra-Orthodox branch of Judaism has been growing, and you know, and because it's growing, is asserting itself more?
Well, it's growing for one simple reason, because they take seriously the commandment to be fruitful and multiply. I mean, that's facetious, but it's also true. They consider part of their purpose to be make big families, to have lots of children. And it's also, a sociologist, you know, might put it in terms of normative behavior. The norm is to have 5, 6, 7, 8 children. If you saw that Israeli movie Kadosh earlier this year, it was about how tormented this Orthodox couple in the movie were by the fact that they couldn't have any children, because that put them so outside the pale of normative Orthodox life, whether in Israel or America. Anyway, so they have a high birth rate to begin with. I don't know what the theology is, frankly, on using contraceptives, but I don't know if that plays a part or not. And they're becoming more assertive because they have a confidence, and some would say a triumphalism, and some would say an arrogance, about having the answers and about the fact that they are growing. And the collective consciousness of the ultra-Orthodox is, here is a group of people who never intended to come to America, who, When other European Jews were calling America the Golden of Medina, the Golden Land, and striving to get here, cobbling up the money to come here in steerage, they were staying in Europe and believing, again, what's new is forbidden by the Torah, that America is not the Golden of Medina, it's the Treif Medina, it's the unkosher land. So here they are, never intended to be here. So they're there in their communities when the Holocaust sweeps over Europe. And like the rest of Jewry in Europe, they're almost totally eradicated. And then you get this handful of survivors who make it to America, a couple of major rabbis, a couple of 100,000 of their followers, this tiny remnant coming here really as refugees rather than immigrants, if you understand the distinction. The refugee leaves out of necessity, not by choice, and never has a sense of, I am choosing to go to America, I want to go to America. It was a case here of, I have to go to America. It's either America or Israel. There's nowhere else to go. There's certainly no going back to Europe after Hitler. They come here, everyone expects them to wither away and die. Instead, they restart their institutions, their yeshivas, their communal groups, their synagogues, their rabbinical associations. They, you know, be fruitful and multiply. Their population grows. And the tremendous confidence, and again, this sort of satisfaction, triumphalism, arrogance that comes with, we weren't eradicated. Not even Hitler could kill us off. And the reason we weren't is because we stayed true to the old ways, to the Torah, to the religion, gives them this kind of feeling of knowing the answer for Jewry writ large.
My guest is Sam Friedman, author of the new book, Jew vs. Jew. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sam Friedman, author of the new book, Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry.
My impression is, and I'd like your opinion of this, that whereas in the 60s and early 70s, a lot of young people, including a lot of Jewish people, young Jewish people, looked to the East for an all-encompassing spirituality that they could become part of. And they became Buddhists or joined cult groups that had borrowed some of the teachings of Buddhism or other Eastern religions or some like mystical sect.
Right.
And I think some of the young people today or in the past decade or two who might have at one time turned to the East are looking to the ultra-Orthodox Jewish faith for that sense of an all-encompassing spiritual experience.
Well, I think you're so right, Terry. I think of the klezmer virtuoso Andy Statman is someone who went through periods of studying Eastern religions, studying Native American religions before finding his way into the Hasidic and ultra-Orthodox world. And there's this wonderful part in Myla Goldberg's novel, Bee Season, about a father who had, you know, was a big spiritual explorer in college, LSD, Eastern religions, all these kinds of mysticism before finding his way to the Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical writings. And you're totally on point when you talk about this encompassing way of life. That's the appeal. And that's, if you want to call it the genius of the Lubavitcher Hasidim, who feel like if we expose you to our way of life, you're going to see it's so encompassing. Really, we have answers for everything. We have a community that's so tightly enmeshed that answers all your feelings of meaninglessness or waywardness in the rest of the world, that you will want to be one of us, that you will become one of us, that every frustration, every doubt you have is going to be in some way ameliorated by being here. And that's, you know, got tremendous appeal, and not just to, you know, to people we would think of as sort of stereotypical lost souls. In Liz Harris's book about the Hasidim holy days, her main character is a woman who was living a pretty conventional middle-brow life in Cincinnati, who just found kind of her heartbreak after her divorce and just her desire for a fuller life answered by becoming a Lubavitcher.
Sam, you belong to a conservative synagogue, and I'm wondering how some of the issues that you address in your book have been manifested in your own synagogue.
Well, the one I belong to now, I've just been in for about a year and a half since I moved back into New York with my family. But when I went for 7 years, as was a member for 7 years at Neve Shalom in Metuchen, the conservative synagogue there, there was this experience where the rabbi, as much of a pluralist as he was not able to give a Torah honor to an extended family member who had been converted by a Reform rabbi. That's one example. I know that the outrage that I felt in my congregation from people who'd been to Israel and experienced some of the attacks on worshipers at the Western Wall was profound. In fact, the attack that I experienced on the receiving end there when it was all over and everyone was kind of, you know, staggering, somewhat dazed and relieved out of the Western Wall area. Who do I run into but the wife of my cantor from my synagogue at home, who said, oh, yeah, there are two other people from the synagogue here. They left, you know, because it was too terrifying having the bottles thrown at us. So those events were talked about. It was really paradoxical for me because I hadn't been really observant. And as I started to come back into it and was really falling in love with the synagogue that I belonged to in New Jersey, it felt like joining a community that was in the middle of tremendous upheaval and rifts right at the same time. You know, I was used to, from my younger days, going to the High Holy Days and hearing a kind of a canned sermon about Jewish unity or a canned sermon about supporting Israel, all these very rote kind of orations. And here I was in 1997 going to Neve Shalom, and the rabbi is talking about how maybe people should be donating money not to the UJA Federation, which was seen as giving too much money to the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, but to groups on the left wing of American and Israeli Jewry, like the New Israel Fund, and thinking, boy, this is really so different from kind of the sense of unanimity that I remembered from being an 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old going to a different synagogue as a boy.
You started going to synagogue regularly fairly recently as at a time when you were a father. And I'm wondering what issues brought you back to the synagogue or brought you to it for the first time, whichever it was. And if you think that that's fairly typical of a lot of Jewish people who have found themselves going more regularly.
Well, I think my road was typical and atypical. You know, I grew up in a family that was wonderfully and staunchly secularly Jewish. My parents both spoke Yiddish. I had an uncle who was in Yiddish theater. My father and his whole family grew up in an anarchist colony. My parents conversed in Yiddish when they didn't want the kids to understand. Out of something ineffable, when I was a kid, I started going to synagogue. I was drawn by something. But I had this episode right before my bar mitzvah where the rabbi decided the reception wasn't kosher enough and refused to bar mitzvah me 2 weeks before the ceremony. And we had to actually run around at the last minute and find a different rabbi to do it. And that seemed to validate everything my parents had said about how sectarian and small-minded organized religion was. So I had a long drift away. What's unusual, I think, about my coming back is that my route there really went through the Black Church. When I was working on Upon This Rock, my book about St. Paul Community Baptist Church in Brooklyn, I was just immersed in this faith community for several years, and it was impossible not to be affected by it. And what was wonderful is that maybe because they were Black Christians and I was a white Jew, no one ever gave me conversion pressure. So I was never getting bothered about, you know, is Jesus my Lord and Savior? But what I did get was this unbelievably profound experience of religion in people's lives. And you just couldn't be unaffected by it. You'd have to be stone inside not to. And that really was the first thing that made me start, or one of the first things that made me want to go back, is I thought, there's something here. There's something about religion or something about being part of a faith community that I'm experiencing here in Black Church that I have to find somewhere in my own world. And that was even before my wife and I had children, but it certainly was magnified. And this is where my story becomes more typical. Once we had our son and daughter, and you start to think, what is there to pass on? And how can I impart something valuable about being Jewish to my kids? Because I don't speak Yiddish the way my father and mother did. I'm not in a Yiddish-speaking garment workers union like my grandfather and namesake was. I don't act in Yiddish theater like my uncle. a lot of the old, really venerable ways of being a cultural Jew in America seem to me to be almost completely absent from the world around me. And yet here was this synagogue half a mile from where we lived with this rabbi who I really connected with people I could sit next to in services on a Saturday who'd help guide me through the liturgy. And just the sense of, I guess, all the years that I was away, I never lost the sense that on Saturday morning there's somewhere I ought to be. And if I wasn't there, some inchoate, not cerebral, primal part of me was saying, why aren't you?
Was it difficult for you to find a synagogue that gave you that sense of a religious community that you had wanted after spending so much time in the Black church that you wrote about?
Well, I expected it to be really difficult. And we moved out to New Jersey at that point. My wife said, there's a synagogue half a mile up the block. Let's join. I said, I'm not going to join just any place because it's close. And I've seen this incredible example of religious community at Reverend Youngblood's church. I know what my standard is. And just pure luck or providence or whatever, we did go up there for a new members meeting. We started to get to know the rabbi a little bit. I went to some early worship services there. And the click was just there. And it was, again, either pure luck or pure providence that I never had to look further, that I just kind of fell into it.
Well, Sam Friedman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks, Terry. It's been a real pleasure to do it.
Sam Friedman is the author of the new book, Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for the Soul of American Jewry. He's a professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on tonight's conclusion of Survivor. This is Fresh Air. Tonight, CBS presents the two-hour conclusion of Survivor, providing the final chapter to this summer's big hit. TV critic David Bianculli, a fan from the start, doesn't know who wins tonight and doesn't want to know until he sees it live along with everybody else. But he does have some thoughts and predictions.
It's been going on for 13 weeks now. Every Wednesday night, castaways on a remote island sit around a tribal council and vote each other off, while viewers at home, watching TV in their living rooms, watch in ever-increasing numbers. Survivor has been a major summer hit since it premiered the last day in May, and for lots of very, very good reasons. One, it has a great cast, and the more we get to know them, the more interesting they become. Second, it has a compelling story, made even more dramatic by the way the competition has been structured and edited. Of the four finalists seen in tonight's episode, three of them, Rudy the ex-Navy SEAL, Richard the corporate guru, and Sue the truck driver, figured prominently in the very first show. Third, there's $1 million at stake, so the tension at this point is real. Fourth, the finale is structured so that the very things that got some of the contestants this far, duplicity, deviousness, backstabbing, can now turn around and stab them in the front. Fifth, the survivor secret of who won was kept by everyone who knew it, and that's a major modern media miracle. The sixth and seventh reasons I think Survivor caught on so big are reasons I think network TV needs to pay attention to the most. It was on during the summer, proving, like last summer's surprise hit Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, that the right TV can draw audiences even during the summer months. And most important of all, perhaps, it was on in the same spot each week, every week. No preemptions, no repeats. If network TV wants to know how to get its audience back, that's one giant clue right there. The next Survivor series, set in Australia and launching after the Super Bowl, may be the first show in TV history to follow that game and get even bigger ratings. For CBS, Survivor has been a major success, boosting its schedule across the board, attracting younger viewers, and getting the sort of invaluable buzz ABC got last year with Millionaire. Meanwhile, we have tonight's 3-hour Survivor Bonanza, the 2-hour finale, followed by a reunion of all 16 survivors who will be interviewed by Bryant Gumbel. Who's the big winner tonight, besides CBS? I don't know, but I'd love to guess. So here's my guess. This is an insider's analysis of the show's final endgame, for people who already know the players and the rules. Unless Kelly wins the last 2 immunity challenges in a row, she's out of there. The rest of the Taghi Alliance intended to vote her out for the last 2 weeks running, but immunity saved her each time. Hitting a 4-time immunity streak seems unlikely, so Kelly's gone. If the final 3 consists of Rudy, Rich, and Sue, Rudy's in trouble. Rich and Sue are the 2 least likable and most manipulative contestants on the island. They're also smart enough to know that if they target each other too early, and the final 2 consists of either one of them and Rudy, then the jury round deciding the winner, a jury consisting of the semifinalists ousted by Rich and Sue, surely will give Rudy the pot. If Rudy can win immunity and reach the final 2, he's the winner. That's one prediction. If the final 2 consists of Rich and Sue, which I see as another probable outcome, then the winner is, I think, Rich. He may have annoyed as many people as Sue did, but he wasn't caught betraying them like she was. But at this point, Rudy is the one I'd like to see win, so he's the one I'll go with. It'll take some luck to get him the rest of the way, but he's had it so far. 13 weeks ago, on the very first show, Sonia was ejected with 4 votes cast against her. Rudy, at that same tribal council, got 3 votes against him. Luck may be with him again tonight. And even if it's not, tens of millions of CBS viewers will, watching to see what happens. Survivor has been one wild roller coaster of a TV ride, and tonight's finale, needless to say, is not to be missed. Not if you want to take part in the office conversations tomorrow morning.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.